Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host for today, Carla Nappi. I recently spoke with David Kirby about his fascinating book, Lab Coats in Hollywood, Science, Scientists, and Cinema, that came out with MIT Press in 2011. Now, this is a book that's both written in an extraordinarily accessible style, so you don't have to have any background in STS to really get a lot out of it and to enjoy it. But at the same time, Kirby is very careful and very clear about the intended contributions to STS in every chapter. And so scholars of STS will see Leviathan and the Air Pump mentioned. We'll see lots of classic and specialized work in STS being brought to bear in a discussion of, frankly, a really fun and really, I'm convinced, important and relevant case study, which is the problems inherent in and the sort of case study of the visual representation of scientists and the sciences in Hollywood cinema and to some extent in television. This is an extraordinarily pressing set of issues, especially for anybody who recently saw Prometheus or is interested in some of the many summer blockbusters this summer in 2012 that feature discussion of and depiction of science and the sciences. And it's also just a super fun book to read. And there's lots of really wonderful anecdotes in here. So it's the kind of book that you could easily assign in a class and also easily take to bed and use for bedtime reading because it's that enjoyable. So yeah, we had a good time talking about it and I hope you enjoy. Hello, David.
Hello.
We're here today to talk with David Kirby about his recent book, Lab Coats in Hollywood, Science, Scientists, and Cinema, and that just came out with the MIT Press in 2011. Now, this is a book that's a lot of fun to read. It's clearly going to appeal to and most likely has appealed to a wide range of people and a wide range of audiences. I'm delighted to be here to talk with you about the book today, David. So thanks so much for making time for us.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure for me. I love talking about this topic. So
it's clear from the book. From the book. So that's a great thing for a reader. Yeah. So, David, can you start us off a little bit about telling us a little bit about your background? Now, you mentioned at the beginning of the book that you actually transitioned from a tenure track position in biology into the field of STS, which is what this book firmly stands within. Can you talk a little bit about that transition for you and what led you to want to make that transition?
Yeah, I know. It's funny. It's a transition that my friend said was a move to the dark side. So moving away from the bench sciences and doing sort of quote unquote real scientific work to look at science from a cultural perspective is a bit of a shift and a bit different. I was trained as a molecular evolutionary biologist and did a lot of lab work for my PhD. And then for 5 years after that, I taught at American University, which is in Washington, D.C., doing biology, so teaching evolution, teaching general biology and classes like that. And I really did love it. But the one thing I didn't quite like as much is doing the lab work. And it's funny, a lot of scientists who make that sort of transition, that's one of the things that, I mean, that's one of the things scientists love, but there are certain that don't sort of love it. And so I decided, I did a sort of film and science night at American where I would show a movie to my students and then we would talk about it. And so I got very interested in questions of science and media. And I actually wrote a couple of articles about the movie Gattaca right after it came out and decided, you know what, this is something that I could do full time. But if I was going to be doing it full time and if I was going to be doing something meaningful, I had to sort of, I think, retrain to really look at how work is done in the humanities and the social sciences. So I got a postdoc through the National Science Foundation. They do what's called a retraining postdoc to take scientists and put them into STS or history of science or communication so that they can write about science from a different perspective. So I did that work at Cornell University in the Department of Science and Technology Studies and in the Department of Communication with a guy named Bruce Lewinstein. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I sort of transitioned into writing about movies and science for a living.
Great. And how long was your postdoc, if you don't mind my asking?
It was just 2 years. It was just, it was a 2 year retraining postdoc. And it was, I mean, one of the things I think that's interesting is that writing about movies is actually not that much different than writing about science. I actually, after my postdoc at Cornell, I went and taught writing for a year at Duke University. And that's what I told the students. They were all science students. And I just kept telling them, evidence is evidence, you know. With the sciences, it's easier to have the evidence. You got, you know, your graph with your lines. But when you're writing in humanities and social sciences, the evidence is there. It just takes more work to sort of convince somebody that the evidence is saying what you want it to say. So it was a 2 year postdoc, but it was a pretty rich 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I started out in paleontology and give a similar explanation to people who are like, what? How did you get from there to Chinese science? What is that?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a big, big leap, but as you know, I mean, it can be done. And having both bits has been incredibly useful for me.
I can imagine. Now, this actually brings us really nicely into the book. And for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book sort of works around several aspects of a major theme, and that is the role of science consultants on TV and especially in film. So most of the examples are actually from film, and the negotiations of expertise that relationship and that involvement involves. Now, how did you decide, given this interest, to work specifically on film and TV as your focus for looking at this this range of problems and the sort of phenomenon of the negotiation of expertise in these different realms?
That's a good question. I mean, one of the things that drew me to the topic of the science consultants was this sort of question of expertise. It was when I sort of wrote these things on Gattaca, I was writing about the text predominantly and the sort of bioethical issues that the text raised, and also then some of the responses to the movie. So responses of geneticists, for example, to the movie. And I began to sort of think, well, there's a lot of work out there. There's a lot of books, actually, and articles where people talk about the science in movies and TV, but no one's sort of asking the question, how did that science actually get there, right? I mean, how did those depictions and representations actually get put into a film? Who was making those decisions? And then when I did a little bit of digging, I realized that, especially when I started the book in the early 2000s, there weren't that many scientists working on these movies, but I did run across a lot of scientists who were working on movies. And that was a sort of revelation. Okay, there are scientists working on movies and on TV shows. So then I sort of asked the question, well, what are these scientists doing? And that led me to this notion of expertise. Well, we can talk about a scientific expert, and you'd say, you know, you go to the general person in the street and say, what's a scientific expert do? And they say, oh, they have knowledge, right? They know scientific facts. That's what a scientific expert is. And then I began to realize, well, that's not actually, you know, if we can think about a scientist on a movie, that's not always what they're doing. And so I began to think, well, what would a filmmaker think of as, you know, quote unquote, science-y enough that they feel they need to bring in an expert? Mm-hmm. Right. What do they think is a scientific expert? And so by using scientists' work on movies, I could really pull out and dissect a bit more about this larger question of what it means to be an expert, and in particular, what it means to be a scientific expert. And if I could add just a little bit more about, you know, why TV and movies, it's funny that most of it is actually on movies, and that was a very specific choice as to why movies, even over television. And some of it some of it was that I just like movies. I mean, I love movies, and so I wanted to write about movies. It was one of the reasons why I left science, is to write about movies. So that was one of the choices. But some of it was methodological as well. I've since done some work on television. I've talked to a lot of one of my next projects after I finished the book was on forensic television programs. So I talked to a lot of writers and producers and some of the creators of shows like CSI and Bones and some shows here in the UK like Waking the Dead. Mm-hmm. And it was a much more difficult mode of research because with a movie it's a single entity, right? It's one product. A television show know, especially one like CSI that's been running for, you know, a dozen years, it's really hard to track down everyone who's worked on it. And each episode can be different, and season to season it's different. So for methodological reasons, it was just easier to sort of nail down with the movie who were the science consultants, who was the script writer, who was the important production designer. So because of that, I decided to limit myself to dealing with movies.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And that actually gets at something that I wanted to ask you about, which is, I mean, given the fact that this is such a fascinating topic, right? And I imagine that when you teach about this and when you have students, you have tons of people who read this and get excited about doing this kind of work, right? So yeah. for yourself, when you were planning the research process, what kind of process did you have to go through in order to get access, and specifically for the film project, for the book that we're talking about today for most of our time, how did you get access to the kinds of people that you wanted to talk with? And is there any particular training that you felt like you needed to undergo to conduct these interviews? I imagine some of these at least were interviews, and can you talk about that process, both, you know, just because it's inherently interesting in understanding the book, and also for listeners who might be interested in potentially getting into this kind of work?
In terms of planning the research, as you mentioned, most of the book is based on interviews that I did, interviews with filmmakers and interviews with scientists. There's some historical aspects to the book, where I had to figure out archival work. And again, as a scientist, doing archival work was interesting. But in terms of doing the interviews and planning those, I didn't have any sort of special training. As part of my postdoc, I did take a course at Cornell on qualitative research methods, and a guy named Michael Lynch at Cornell, he did the session on interviews, and it was his advice came down to two things, you know, do them live if you can, you know, go in person if you can, and make sure you have batteries in your recording device, which is something I forgot at one point in one of the interviews. It was really a shame that the batteries ran out at some point on it. But in order to sort of find these people, it took a while. I mean, today, if I were to do the book again today, it would be much easier. Now every scientist who works on a movie, even the smallest bit of a movie, they're crowing about it on the internet. You could find even Prometheus that just came out.
Right.
There was an article in the Washington Post about it. There are dozens of articles on the web where you can find every scientist who did any little bit of piece of work on Prometheus. But back in the early 2000s, it was actually much more difficult. I looked at credits, the film credits, to see, because sometimes they would, and we could get into this later when we talk about compensation, but that was one of the things they do for the scientists. Here's your credit, you know, right. Technical advisor, you know, Dr. Smith. So I did that. I looked at a book called the American Film Institute catalog, which is now online, and you could search through that. So I looked through that for any indication that a scientist had worked on a movie. In addition to the credits, there are also thank yous at the end of a movie. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm one of those guys who always stays to the end of the credits. And for this, I had to, because I had to look to see, you know, we thank the following individuals.
Sure.
So it took quite a bit, actually. And then asking a lot of people. So when I interviewed people, I would ask them if they had worked with anyone. So for filmmakers, in general, you just go through their agent. Mm-hmm. And just tell them you're an academic, some didn't answer back.
That's typical.
But yeah, for the filmmakers, every scientist did. I mean, scientists love to talk about it. I mean, those guys, they were just excited to talk to anyone about this work. But for some of the filmmakers, you know, they're busy people. They didn't really want to talk. But if I did get to talk to them, then I would ask them, you know, who else should I be talking to? Because a lot of this is informal work. And so the only way to get certain people was for the filmmaker to say, oh yeah, I think I called that paleontologist or that astronomer.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So getting sort of further into the book, I mean, you mentioned Prometheus, and this is actually, I'm not going to ask you to talk about that, because I imagine lots of people are asking you to talk about that. But the theme of space exploration and sort of the involvement of scientific consultants in movies that have something to do with space is actually a very prominent theme in the book. It's one of the major cases or of films that you look at in different ways through the book. So we will actually get to that. And I do want to hear a little bit more about that in general. Now, as we sort of move through the book, there are issues of, we'll come back to this, sort of not just expertise, but if we had to point to some of the other major kind of thematic notions in STS that really permeate a lot of STS work, it's not just expertise, but also issues of accuracy and authenticity and authorship. So because I know this is a work that's meant not just to speak to people interested in film, right? I mean, this is written in a way that's very accessible, but also to inform STS scholarship. You do a very good job in these chapters of mentioning along the way sort of major works that shaped the way you're thinking thematically of the major themes in each chapter. So to sort of get us into that, can you talk a little bit about what are some of the major works that shaped the way you're thinking about these problems, maybe from the STS field, and sort of works that shaped your theses in the book?
As an academic, one of my primary audiences, I'm imagining, is the STS community, even though it's been picked up by sort of popular presses and people talk about science and movies. My goal was to contribute something meaningful to science and technology studies, like I said, about notions of accuracy, but also about creation of knowledge, just in general. But some of the works that influenced me, we could talk more about it. And although it comes from the history of science, Leviathan and the Air Pump, the idea of virtual witnessing was something that was really crucial in terms of my thinking about how a movie could impact the ways in which we formulate knowledge, or our perspectives about the natural world could be influenced by a movie. Right? And so their idea of virtual witnessing, which I'm more or less co-opting, I mean, they talk about it in terms of literary work and writing scientific articles. But I sort of co-opt it and talk about movies as a virtual witnessing technology. The idea that we cannot directly see how scientists come up with their facts, right? I mean, only the scientists coming up with it actually can look through their microscope or see their radiograph and determine that. So a movie can have this powerful influence, also because it's sort of embedded within a narrative. So Leviathan and the Air Pump was certainly a major influence. The work of Harry Collins on expertise was something that got me thinking a lot about this. And also his ideas about the core set was something that I was interested in. And he wrote an article about science in documentaries that was also very influential in terms of thinking about the idea of media being removed from the production of knowledge as being something that was very important. So those sort of ideas coming from him were important to me. Mike Lynch's work on mathematization and the idea of representation was important. Along those lines, Bruno Latour's work on immutable mobiles, that was also very crucial in my thinking. And even though, you know, within STS, it could still be very controversial, the actor network theory notion, the notion of ally gathering, for me, the scientists who work on these movies and who put forward their ideas, for me, that really gets at this notion of ally gathering. They're trying to convince as many people as possible that, you know, dinosaurs came from birds, or that they're birds came from dinosaurs, or that the Earth's core moves in a particular way. They are trying to gather allies for their ideas. So that work was also, I think, very important for me.
Right. And this also sort of gets at something that I think is very powerful in the book, in which it seems like you're arguing that these what we might think of as these two separate realms, right? Entertainment, media, and science are actually not separate from each other. And you're sort of showing us step by step here, very concrete cases and concrete ways in which it's not just that film acts as a way to disseminate perceptions of science to the public, but rather you're making very clear arguments here that dissemination of these ideas through entertainment media and through film in particular actually has the potential to impact knowledge production itself in the sciences, yeah. Right?
Absolutely. And that came out of my 2-year postdoc at Cornell very strongly, is that that was one of the things that I was really interested in doing, was to say, all right, how can we go to this sort of extreme and figure out how even something like a movie, even something that should be seen as fluff, can really impact the way in which scientists and the public at large perceive of the natural world. When I was doing the postdoc, I wish I could remember the article, but we read someone who looked at math and was sort of showing that, you know, even with mathematics, you could find some social construction going on. And the idea was that by going to the hardest of hard sciences and finding that you know, everything else sort of comes away from that. And for me, it was the same. It was like, well, if I can go to movies and show that a movie impacts the way that scientists can think about a topic, that should be able to help us think about all the other things even below that, like documentaries as well.
And there are many examples of this that come up through the book, and we could sort of get there chapter by chapter, but since we're there right now, can you say a little bit about one or two examples of the cases in which this kind of use of entertainment media to disseminate, shape, portray, represent science actually did shape, but also sort of shape knowledge production in the sciences?
Yeah, I mean, ones that I liked quite a bit was from the movie King Kong, mm-hmm. Where the consultant that they brought on for their Tyrannosaurus Rex, because in King Kong, the sort of Kong dinosaur battles are sort of one of the highlights of the movie. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to make sure, and the guy Willis O'Brien, who was doing the special effects, as well as his sculptor Marcel Delgado, they were interested in authenticity and accuracy. So for their T-Rex, they brought in a guy named Barnum Brown. And he was famous for his reconstruction of T-Rex for the Natural History Museum in New York. And, you know, when I give talks, I show the sort of a still from the movie and say, you know, look at this image. You can see that it's got three fingers. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong. We know that's wrong. Now we know that's wrong. Does that mean they didn't listen to him? Well, no. It turns out that they listened to him too much. At the time, he was really adamant that Tyrannosaurus Rex had three fingers, mm-hmm. like Allosaurus. And he was absolutely adamant that they had to put it that way. Okay. But at the time, people didn't actually know whether it had three fingers or two fingers. If they had talked to a guy named Charles Gilmore from the Smithsonian, then they would have had it as two fingers because he believed it was like Gorgosaurus. But from that movie, that's an influential movie on dinosaur representation. So a lot of Tyrannosaurus Rexes after that had three fingers. And that's the way people sort of began to perceive Tyrannosaurus Rex, mm-hmm. until much later, when people actually found evidence that it actually had two fingers. So that's one of my favorite examples. The one that's probably the biggest example has to do with Jurassic Park. So Jurassic Park is incredibly influential in terms of the ways in which we perceive dinosaurs. At the time, the perception of dinosaurs in many ways was open to debate. Were they warm-blooded or not? Could they move in a particular way? Did they do parenting, right? Did they actually parent their offspring? And the one in particular I look at in the book is the idea of birds from dinosaurs.
Right.
And the consultant for the movie, Jack Horner, was very upfront about his motivation for working on the film, or at least one of his motivations, was to get people thinking about dinosaurs as bird-like. That was one of his motivations. And so there's a lot in the movie that he helped shape that goes towards that. The idea of the birds flocking, or the dinosaurs hunting, he says at one point, like a flock of predators. And even at the beginning of the movie, when they're looking at a velociraptor and he's sort of pointing at all the sort of avian features about the dinosaur, that was all done in mind to get people thinking about birds as dinosaurs. And that movie did. It changed the public's perception. And one of the things I show in the book is scientists are not immune from that as well. And so it changed a lot of scientists' perspectives. And if you look at scientific debate around the time of the, or before the movie, lots of debate about this. After the movie, it becomes, you know, it's STS term, black box. Now everybody thinks of dinosaurs as birds. You still get some people today who disagree, ornithologists, developmental biologists. Many of them don't like the idea, but now it's an uphill battle for them. The battle has been won because of Jurassic Park, literally, that we think of birds as dinosaurs.
And this gets at not only this phenomenon that you mentioned earlier, films acting as virtual witnessing technologies, right? Not just for the public, but also for other scientists, perhaps, that are watching the film. And it also gets at this issue that is featured in the same chapter, chapter two, where you raise and I think discuss very eloquently the use of films as virtual witnessing technologies. And this is this idea of plausibility, right? This is a perfect example, this Jurassic Park example of a film sort of rendering a theory, in this case Horner's theory, plausible by naturalizing it using the sort of frame, using the tools of visual narrative.
Right? Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the naturalization process is very important. And I should point out, it's not Horner's theory. It was a theory of a lot of paleontologists. He was just one who was just championing it, and he got the opportunity to really champion it in the movie. The naturalization process is really important in giving a scientific idea that type of plausibility. So it's not just the visuals. So in Jurassic Park, the visuals are really important. The CGI, the way the dinosaurs move. They made it so that the dinosaurs moved in a naturalistic fashion. But it's also a narrative structure built around it, right? You have those characters interacting with those dinosaurs, makes them that much more believable. And you have a narrative that's really geared towards proving the sort of scientists in the movie's ideas about dinosaurs as birds. So that all makes you buy into this scientific concept much more than if you were just reading a popular magazine article about dinosaurs being, descending into birds. That's, I think, a lot of what movies can do for science, mm-hmm. and why scientists often will want to work on movies to get their ideas across.
And why else would scientists want to work on movies to get their ideas across? And I know I ask this to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the compensation issue. There's a whole chapter devoted to this. So why would scientists want to do this? And sort of Horner is actually an interesting example of this, given how you discuss them in here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a number of reasons why scientists do this type of consulting. And first and foremost, I should say that for them, it's fun. I mean, we all can be prone to that type of celebrity culture, right? I mean, we all, no matter. I mean, the first lady just said Rihanna was the woman she wanted to be, right? We love celebrities. So every scientist as well would love to be interacting with movie makers. So they just like that celebrity culture. But the other reasons they do it, one is for the public understanding of science. Mm-hmm. So someone like myself who teaches on science communication and knows that literature, we know that from the 1980s, that's when the public understanding of science movement really came forward and really became solidified. So a lot of these scientists feel they have to do this, that it's a service to science, mm-hmm. That the science in movies is wrong. Therefore, if I work on this, I'm doing a service by making sure it's right and not sort of, hurting the minds of the public who can't separate fact from fiction. So they do that type of thing as well. This sort of impacts their compensation, which is what you're sort of alluding to. Mm-hmm. The compensation issue becomes sort of strange. because the scientists feel they need to do it as a public service. They feel as a scientist, knowledge is free. This is what we became scientists for. But by the same token, they also realize, well, you know what? I'm working on a multi-million dollar movie that's going to be making somebody else a lot of money. And I'm giving my time here, so I need some sort of compensation out of this. And often they come up with sort of creative solutions, which Jack Horner did. He gets out of it. They give money to him to fund his research. And it, like I said, as a former paleontologist, you understand how difficult it is to find money to do that.
Right.
So for Jack Horner, this is fine. That's a good trade-off. He's not getting a salary out of it. He's getting money that's going back towards the scientific process. What he also gets out of it, and many scientists do, is publicity. And even scientists need publicity. And again, if you want to show your funders that you're doing things, having your name attached to a big blockbuster movie that's using your ideas and your science, that's very good.
Broader impact and
exactly.
engagement.
Yeah, exactly. It's broader impact. Mm-hmm. And we can come back to this as to why certain governmental organizations have become involved in this as well, because that's part of their remit. But I could also, you know, if you want to talk at this point about the danger for scientists in doing that type of thing.
Sure, whatever.
As well. Yeah, because for Jack Horner, it's great. He gets a lot of publicity. He gets some research funds off of it. But the filmmakers also are using him for publicity, right? Mm-hmm. They're using the famous scientist Jack Horner, has authenticated our film and said that it's doing, you know, the science is as authentic as, you know, it possibly could be. But we also want to use Jack Horner, the public figure, to publicize the movie. So that means that his discoveries they want to use as the film comes out. So when a Jurassic Park film came out, they were using Jack Horner's discoveries to sort of publicize their work. And what happened to him is that the filmmakers asked him to sort of hold back on announcing a discovery until the movie came out, so that they could piggyback off of that type of publicity as well. And what happened to him, unfortunately, is that a lot of his scientific colleagues felt very put off by that, that it seemed as if he was sort of fudging the discovery date for a particular Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton. So it made it seem as if he wasn't being objective in doing this work. He was actually doing the work at the behest of filmmakers. So there were some dangers in getting involved in that way.
Right. And you have just mentioned the sort of the different issues, or not entirely different, but related issues that come into play when we're talking about institutional interest in getting involved in this kind of relationship, which brings us to NASA potentially. And, or as an example, and I just use this as an example in the book of this kind of larger scale involvement that you give us lots of examples of, you know, cases in which NASA supported the use of the logo and the name in the film, and some cases where they actually balked at some of the representations of NASA and astronauts, for example, Red Planet, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. And NASA as an institution, it's put in a bad place, right? It's publicly funded, and yet what it produces is not necessarily all that useful. So they're constantly having to publicize themselves. And so that's why they have become involved in making movies. And they've done it for quite a long time, going back to the 1960s. And there are sort of very strict rules for whether or not they will work with you. And you have to sign a sort of, I think they call it the Space Act Agreement, saying you'll do certain things and you won't do certain things. And they always maintain that they don't tell the filmmakers what they can and can't do. But they are very aware of how the depiction of NASA or astronauts are in movies. Mm-hmm. So they did allow the filmmakers to use the NASA logo for Mission to Mars. And they became very involved in that. Or film like Space Cowboys or Deep Impact, Armageddon, mm-hmm. things like that. But for the film Red Planet, initially they became involved, and then they realized that there is a scene in that movie where one astronaut inadvertently kills another astronaut, sort of pushes him off a cliff. But NASA balked at that and said, no, that gives a bad image of what astronauts are. Therefore, we cannot lend our name to this, right? We can't have that being the public image for the way astronauts come across. So, yeah, and as well, there's a recent movie called Apollo 18 that you may have seen, a horror movie. They initially were going to be involved, and then they looked at it and said, no, we can't be involved in this. This doesn't give space exploration a very good name. Now, the strange thing about it in some ways is that what they really want is for NASA to be seen as heroic, right, as sort of solving problems and not seen as having any problems. And Mission to Mars, even though they gave their okay to it and sort of signed off on it, that features very heavily, the plot very heavily relies on the face on Mars, right? The controversial sort of pseudoscience idea that there are ancient Martians who created this face. It's a thing that it's pseudoscience that NASA has been trying for years to get people not to believe. And for them, because the movie Mission to Mars made it seem like going to Mars was a good idea, right? It supports this idea of spending money to travel to Mars. They were okay with it. And yet they really had to do a PR maneuvers afterward to sort of defend and say, no, we don't legitimate the face. You know, the face isn't part of what NASA supports. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's in many ways, it's great for organizations to get involved, but there are, again, are always dangers.
Right. And I think anyone listening to this who's ever had the experience writing a funding application as an academic will know that there are always interests involved in getting any money for any research that you have to negotiate, right? And so in some cases, this is a really kind of very trenchant or very sort of clear example of more subtle relationships that all of us have to negotiate anytime we want to get any funding. And often public impact or potential sort of public engagement is a huge part of determining even how history research gets funded.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And that's an excellent point because here in Britain as well, there's a lot of stuff with the impact. Now that the Cameron government has come in, it's been a big shift to how is your research impacting. And you're absolutely right. In these guys' cases, the movie makers expect certain things from these scientists for any money or grant money that they give them, or for the recognition that they give for being involved in these movies.
Mm-hmm. But that's one might say, I'm not saying you're saying, but I'll just say that that's perhaps the case, you know, although not made as explicit anytime any organization gives you anybody. But you mentioned Mars, and so that lets me move to a later chapter, which is actually quite fascinating as a scholar of STS or a scholar who works in STS. And this is your chapter on cinematic fact-checking, where you're talking about sort of what exactly counts as a scientific fact in film. And this is a really, from this point on, the chapters get very, very, I think, wonderfully subtle in the way that you're deconstructing ideas from STS that perhaps we don't understand with as much nuance as we might. And you're showing us here the sort of more nuanced ways to think about even, you know, what counts as a scientific fact and how that's actively negotiated in this relationship between cinematic and scientific communities. So in particular, I want to sort of ask you to speak to this issue of what represents an accurate description. And Mars brings this up because the issue of, you know, how does Mars become red in a film? It sort of speaks just as much to what textbook science or what sort of public perceptions of science lend to the aura of plausibility and authenticity of a particular scientific fact as much as it has to do with what's, you know, accepted in contemporary scientific discourse about that. So can you sort of speak to this issue of public familiarity and how that impacts what does and doesn't get treated as a scientific fact in the experiences of the movies that you're talking about here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what's great about that chapter is that it's very STS heavy. And yet, my book's gotten a number of reviews in sort of scientific journals, and many of them actually really like that chapter. Mm-hmm. They really can understand and see how what we consider a fact is very negotiable. Mm-hmm. And very up in the air in many cases. And in that chapter, I talk about the different ways that well, the different types of facts that a filmmaker has to deal with. And it's all couched in the notion of accuracy. When do they change something? Mm-hmm. And when do they feel they can actually change something? Or when do they have to make a decision is more really the case, because they'll change. The filmmaker, they do sort of have some sort of cases of conscience, you know, do I change this fact? But more or less, it's just, is it easy or hard? Mm-hmm. But they think through it and say, well, is this a fact that everybody knows? Is this a fact that my sixth grader will know? Right. If that's the case, it's something I call public science. Right. It's something that everybody is going to know. And in those cases, the filmmakers think very long and hard about it. And as one of the filmmakers said, you know, we don't want to look stupid. Right. If everybody knows this is true and we change it, we're going to look really stupid. So, yeah, there's what I call public science. And so they think about that. And those they try not to change for those reasons. And one of the examples I give is the movie Contact, the number of prime numbers, where they really wanted one to be a prime because it would have made their scene that much more better. They start the number sequence with a one. And a two, it just seems more ominous. And the consultant, she said, you know, they called her four or five times, you know, are you sure one isn't a prime? You know, we really, I said, one to three in the morning, she got this phone call and they're just begging her to make one a prime. But they knew, all right, even if, you know, if grade schoolers know this. The other thing is that they have to think, well, is this something that only scientists immersed in the field are going to know? Is this going to be something that only a handful of scientists in the world are going to know? Mm-hmm. And that's something I refer to as expert science. So the example that I give is, again, from Contact, where it was the sound that you would get from a radio signal. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is that I talked to a couple of different consultants on it, and two consultants independently told them that the sound they were using was wrong. They said, no, it would be like a pure whistle. I guess in a podcast, I could try to do a whistle. I don't know if that will come through. It's just a pure tone, right? It's a pure whistle tone. And each time they said, oh, no, that's each time they said that's what it would do. They listened to the sound that they actually use, which is a crunching noise. It's like a and they said, that's not correct. So they took it back to the sound editor and he was just like, no, we're going with the more interesting sound. Mm-hmm. Because how many people are going to know that this is wrong? Mm-hmm. And they asked one of the scientists, he said, well, I don't know, maybe about 20, 30 people. He's like, all right, well, there you go. You know, everyone else is going to want the more interesting sound. So there's public science and there's expert science. And the interesting thing is that public and expert science can change. Back in the 1920s, a film called Frau im Mond, which I also talk about quite a bit in the book, there they walk around on the moon without spacesuits, right? Because not everybody at that time actually knew that there wasn't an atmosphere on the moon. Mm-hmm. So that concept was actually expert science. Not everyone knew it. But once you move along to the 1950s, there, most people are aware there's not an atmosphere on the moon. So you have to sort of keep that. And today, that's total public science. If you had characters walking around the moon without spacesuits, you'd be, you know, killed over it. The one that you were sort of alluding to about Mars is the more fascinating one, in that it's a fact that the public thinks is true, but it's not actually true. It seems common sense, but it's not scientifically true. And that I refer to as folk science. Mm-hmm. So in this case, the one you're talking about is the idea of how do you depict Mars, mm-hmm. the color of Mars. And filmmakers traditionally make it red. And even if you look at the most recent Mars movies, they still make it very red. And the guy I spoke to who worked on the film Mission to Mars, he said, yeah, they were going to film everything through a red filter to make it very red. And I said, well, didn't you tell them that Mars isn't actually red? And he just, you know, he just got all excited and he said, you know, it's the red planet. It's not the yellow brown planet. You know, people need it to be red. People want it to be red. And that's when I understood the idea of audience expectations being a major driver of the decisions filmmakers make. So folk science is even harder to overturn than public science, because if everybody expects it to be red and it's not, they're going to walk away saying, oh, your movie's inaccurate. You know, Mars wasn't red. So this idea of audience expectations really drives a lot of the decisions that filmmakers make.
And this is actually something that persists through the next couple of chapters, where you're moving us from cases – I mean, from this particular case in which there's a clear perceived distinction between folk science and or popular science, right, and expert science, to cases where there's actually flexibility or uncertainty in the expert science itself. And you spoke to this a little bit already when talking about Horner's theories in Jurassic Park, the bird-like dinosaurs, and also talking about this idea of the Earth's core being a giant uranium ball in this movie, The Core, which is also a wonderful example. But you sort of move in the next chapter to cases which are even more striking in some ways, which is sort of the cases of fantastical science, right? Like Amelie's The Hulk, or Hulk. It's just Hulk.
Yeah. Right? It's just Hulk.
Okay, yeah. It's just Hulk. And here we get to an issue that I'd love to hear more about, which is the sort of how expectations, either scientific and or public and or cinematic, affect the sort of construction of scientific plausibility in cases that everybody knows aren't going to happen. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's another particularly fascinating chapter.
Absolutely. And the idea, like, to just sort of reiterate this idea of audience expectations, if I were to rewrite the book today, and after talked to more filmmakers and more TV people, it's a phrase that they constantly use in what they're doing. The audience expects this to happen. And I would just play up that even more in the book, because it does drive a lot of their creative decisions. But yeah, the notion of sort of fantastical depictions, fantastical science, I think is what I call it. When I teach, I show my students the opening credits for Hulk, which has this great sort of him figuring out, you know, all the genetic modification and all that sort of thing. And I ask my students to say, okay, is that an accurate depiction of science in that movie? And it, because they're mostly science, I teach mostly science students, and they get all confused and they're starting to work through it. And I say, you know, no, I'm not asking you if it's an accurate depiction of the comic book. Is it an accurate scientific depiction? Because as science students, they always think, oh, yeah, it has to be accurate. There has to be something accurate, you know. And then ultimately they come to the right decision, which is it can't be accurate. It's the Hulk. The Hulk doesn't exist. There's no way for the Hulk to exist in the real world. So asking whether or not it's accurate is really the wrong question. That doesn't mean anything. This idea of audience expectations, though, also gets at the notion of the audience expects the Hulk to be a certain way, right? The audience expects the Hulk to be green. The audience expects the Hulk to be invincible to bullets. The audience expects the Hulk to be super strong. And so when you're making a movie like that, you have to play towards those. And so the scientific explanation that you come up with has to have those elements. You can't have a pink Hulk, right? Because the audience expects the Hulk to actually be green. So when you're doing that type of thing, you have to play towards what the audience is going to want. And the job of a science consultant, if they're a good science consultant, that's what they're going to be doing, is to not change what you do, but to help you make it seem plausible and logical. And if you want, I could talk about the other example in the book. The two examples I talk about in that chapter, one is a movie called Solar Crisis, which was useful. It didn't come out in the U.S., but it's useful because the science consultant on it, a guy named Richard Turrell from JPL, it was a movie about going into the sun. And he said he sat there in the meeting and he just kept raising his hand and saying, no, we can't go into the sun. That's impossible. Why don't you do heliometography instead? Or trying to find right reasons. And then he said after, you know, 40 minutes of it, his friend next to him nudged him and just said, Rich, that's the movie. The audience expects them to go into the sun. So they have to go into the sun. And he realized his job was just to make it more plausible for them to do that. Now, we worked on a movie called The Core, which we've talked about. And in that case, he actually walked off the set and in protest. He came back later, as he told me. He said, look, I do a lot of work with filmmakers. I can't be known as a guy who's going to walk out on filmmakers. I'll help them finish their thing. But the reason he walked out is that they came to him and said, this movie is about the core stopping – our explanation is the core stops spinning. Mm-hmm. Help us make that accurate. And he said, well, no, let me come up with a different explanation for why they have to go. I get it. They have to go to the middle of the earth. I get that. Let me come up with something else. And they said, no, that's the explanation we came up with. Help us make that good. So for the science consultants, it really was this idea of they are fine with the sort of fantastical stuff, but what they want is for you to let them come up with reasons to make it more plausible. Don't tell them the thing and say, make it plausible. Let them come up with it the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we move to the final chapters of the book, one of the really wonderful things that chapter 8 and 9 do is really move us concretely from sort of focusing on these negotiations as they impact the way the films portray these phenomena to really focusing back on how this film portrayal is really concretely in a number of really very evocative and fascinating cases impacting, in some cases, the actual development of scientific knowledge and technologies. And also it sort of is being actively manipulated by scientific consultants to evoke a particular public response to a scientific idea. And so you do this in chapter 8 by sort of looking at the way consultants sort of find the film medium to be a method of conveying to the public that an issue needs more attention, right? There are many wonderful examples in here of scientific disaster films. And in particular, you mentioned The Day After Tomorrow in its sort of evocation of the potential impacts of a way of understanding the repercussions of climate change, right? I'll sort of be really careful with the way I'm phrasing this, right? And also the other example, which brings up two films that recur throughout the book, which is the film's Deep Impact and Armageddon, and their used to convey a particular idea of the danger of near-Earth objects. So could you speak to sort of either one of these cases and sort of say a little bit about the significance for the larger argument of the book in the chapter?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I refer to this as the War Games effect. It's a phrase I'm borrowing from a film scholar named Joel Black. Although, again, if I were to redo it, I also talk about them being sort of ghosts of Christmas future, right? Because the idea is, like in the Dickens novel, showing the public what could happen if they don't take a certain path, if they don't fund if they don't start believing that climate change is real, or if they don't start funding ways to search the sky for near Earth objects, then this future is going to come to pass. And it's a horrible future where the Earth is hit by an asteroid and we all die, kind of thing. Day After Tomorrow is actually fascinating because it evoked a lot of controversy because scientists didn't know how to handle it. But on the one hand, you had this film that was raising awareness, right, about climate change, which is what they really wanted. They wanted people to take climate change seriously. It was an election year. It was 2004. The filmmakers were hoping this was going to raise awareness about the Bush administration's policies on climate change. But on the other hand, it's a film that was inevitably going to have scientific inaccuracies. The climate change was going to happen too quickly. The way in which it happened was based on a hypothesis that is legitimate but marginalized, and the sort of extent of the exchange, the climate change was also very extreme. So the scientists responding to it didn't know what they wanted to do, whereas the scientist who worked on it, he was of the mind, look, I know there's going to be inaccuracies in here, but the power of this film to put climate change in the public consciousness is so great that I have to work on this movie. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the reason the filmmakers asked him to be the science consultant is not because he's the world's greatest climate change scientist. It's because he was involved in a lot of political work. So at the being involved in the Rio discussions, the Kyoto Protocol, he knew all of that. He advised a lot of members of Congress about climate change policy. So they wanted him to make sure that the political aspects were right. The science policy interface rang true. And no matter what those who are against climate change thought about that film, they knew that those aspects were right, that those rang true. Their position was done properly. The science of politics was done properly. So yeah, it really can call attention, and it did. There was a lot of discussion around that time, and in conjunction with An Inconvenient Truth, you could say both of those films really raised the discussion in terms of awareness of people thinking about those.
Right. And this is, and I know we've taken up a whole lot of your time, but I don't want to let you go and wrap this up before asking you about chapter 9 a little bit. And this is a chapter where you're talking about consultants using cinematic representation of particular technologies or scientific advances to reduce anxiety, you say, and stimulate desire in audiences to see the potential become the actual. And this is, I think, of particular interest to historians of technology as well. And for sort of people working on technology studies, this was a really interesting chapter in that case. Now, you present an idea in this chapter that I'm going to phrase this as just asking you to say a bit about that and perhaps talk about any of the examples that you find most fascinating in here that speak to this. And this is the idea of diegetic prototypes. So cinematic representations or depictions of future technologies. So can you talk a little bit about what those are and some examples that you think are particularly important in discussing this phenomenon?
Yeah, it's got sort of a funny name, diegetic prototype. But the reason for that is it's a prototype. It's the idea that it's a technology that doesn't exist yet, but that people are thinking about. And it's different than technologies where science fiction filmmakers maybe make something up. These are engineers and scientists who are thinking about these ideas. They've crafted these prototypes, and they've put them into the film, into what we call the diegesis, right, which is the actual film world. So it exists within the diegesis as an actual object that the characters are interacting with. And these are important because it socializes the technology. It gets people thinking about what these technologies can be and what they can do. And it makes them, as I said, it sort of stimulates desire. It makes them think, I want that technology. One of my favorite examples comes from the film Minority Report. It's a science consultant named John Underkoffler. He got a PhD from the MIT Media Lab. And as he was working on his PhD, the filmmakers went through, they were touring MIT, and they saw his work and said, oh, yeah, that's something we want to put in the movie. And when he got hired as a consultant, he really approached it as a sort of R&D project that he was going to work through what was called the gestural interface, which if anyone remembers the film, it's where Tom Cruise moves around data on the screen with his hands. Mm-hmm. And so Underkoffler, he worked through an entire language for the interface. He worked through exactly what you would do with the interface. And he even included what could potentially be seen as a quote unquote flaw of the gestural interface. He actually walked up to Spielberg and said, I've got an idea to make this thing look more realistic. I'm going to add what would be seen as a flaw. And at first Spielberg was like, no, can't do it. You know, we want this. This needs to look perfect. That's the technologies of movies are all supposed to look perfect. And he said, no, this will make it look even more real because we all know technology is flawed. Right, we've all encountered flaws on our laptops every day, and so what he had him do was someone goes to shake his hand, and when he goes to shake his hand, all the data on the screen gets shunted into the corner. So it seems like a problem of the system, but in reality, for Underkoffler, A, it made it seem more real. It seems like, yeah, this is real technology. We can see how this could become a reality. What it also did was one of the criticisms of these types of interfaces is that they're not sensitive enough, right? That you can't actually move data around with your hands. By doing that, it makes it look too sensitive. So it actually played into what he wanted people to come away with, is to say, yeah, it could work, and it could work too well in that sort of way. And because of that film, he got calls from venture capitalists saying, is that real? If not, can we give you money to make it real? And through that, he got the money to create a real prototype. It's called G-Speak technology. And from that prototype, he was able to get money from the U.S. Defense Department to turn it into a real system that they're now using. So, yeah, that's one of my favorite sort of examples. And it really is this idea of film contextualizing and socializing these technologies. And I should point out that the notion of the diegetic prototype has actually been picked up within the design community. Of the things in the book, it's the one thing where people are actually using this as a real term. There's a guy at the Nokia Future Laboratory called Julian Bleeker, who's really a champion of this and talks about this in terms of design fiction that he uses. And I should say one of my proudest things is the science fiction author Bruce Sterling blogged about diegetic prototypes and sort of used and talked about them and championed them as something the design community should be using, thinking about using fiction, create technologies, and get people thinking about them in different ways.
That's fantastic. Well, David, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I don't want to take up too much more. But there's clearly a ton of stuff in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. There's a whole wealth of examples and ideas and engagements with STS literature and just really wonderful anecdotes in here. For listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, is there anything that you want to point out to make sure that they know before we close up today?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit of different ground. I mean, the one thing that we didn't talk about a lot is this idea of acting like a scientist.
Right.
That was one of the things that I talk about quite a bit, which for anyone seeing the new Prometheus film, that's actually what's wrong with the film, is that the scientists don't actually act like real scientists would act. And one of the things I address in the book is, what does it mean to be a real scientist? What does it mean to act like that? That sort of aspect of it, I think, is the one that I would also sort of point people towards, sort of discussion of, what does it mean to be a scientist and to portray one on the screen?
Great. And do you have any plans to write about Prometheus or teach using Prometheus? I just saw it a couple nights ago.
Yeah. Well, by the time the podcast gets out there, the blog post I've done will probably be out. There's a group in Los Angeles I should mention as well called the Science and Entertainment Exchange that is through the National Academy of Sciences. They give scientists out to filmmakers quite frequently. For their blog, I did a post on Prometheus. My next book that I'm working on at the moment, the tentative title is Playing God, Science, Religion, and Cinema. And it's looking at how science or religious communities have responded to movies. So I'm looking at a lot of censorship archives and looking at a lot of contemporary films. So the blog post is about it's historically about how Christian groups have responded to the idea of alien visitors to the earth. But also focusing on how Christian groups have responded to that aspect of Prometheus, the idea that alien visitors have come here in the past and created us out of their DNA. That's sort of the next book that I'm working on. And there will be a blog post on that within the next week at the Science and Entertainment Exchange.
Wonderful. So I'll Science and Entertainment Exchange. So I'll try to make sure to put a link to that also in the write-up on the website.
Well, okay, great.
David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. It's a fascinating book. It's a wonderful read, and I've had a good time talking with you about it. So thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was a pleasure for me, certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will see you next time.